Tell me something about how you started first preaching, who some of the preachers were that had a big influence on you, and you started out with who you traveled with, and what some of the issues were you dealt with back then.
Well, I didn't travel with anyone, but I'll start in 1951, the Sulphur Meeting, and I'll go backwards. When Brother King asked me to travel with him, and I didn't. Brother Gay asked me to travel with him, and I felt honored those brethren asked me. But I told them my plans were to marry someday, raise a family, be a teacher and an elder in the Lord's Church, and they both said, that's really good. We wouldn't discourage you at all. But the preachers that really influenced me as a young man was Paul Nichols, Chester King, which is a brother-in-law of Paul Lynn, and Irvin Waters. Irvin was really a great preacher. And then there was Clovis Cook. Those men that are nearly all gone now, except Paul, you know, and Irvin, they were men that influenced me. Then Brother King and Brother Gay. That was influenced by these men. And I love Billy Orton. When he was a young man, he held his first meeting, I believe, in Irvin, a home. And Billy was a good preacher as a young boy. And so we became acquainted with a lot of the young preachers starting out. And Brother Johnny Elmore, who was just a teenage preacher then, we'll say, traveled with Linwood. And he and my brother Wayne were very close friends with all of us, Johnny was. And I learned a lot from Johnny, especially about singing. And Clovis rooted me in the rudiments and encouraged me to lead songs. When I was leading a song in our practice section, sessions, Clovis would stand behind me and I was left-handed, you know. He'd take my hand and he'd work behind me, you know, on a song, teach me the rhythm of the song and what the signs were, the key signature and all that, and as well as preaching. So men like that influenced me a lot. They were the same every time you saw them or heard them, you know. They all preach the same thing down the line in the meetings. They'd preach the first principles in the gospel meeting, and we almost always had visitors, and many a time that'll be the gospel. My grandmother was really the great influence to get Jim Russell to thinking that we would change over, basically. And so we did. My grandmother was raised in Montague County in the Forestburg area, farming there. My great-grandfather was Samuel Royal, and he's buried in the Diamond Cemetery in not far from Wichita Falls. He farmed and preached too. I have a book my uncle gave me, shows a picture of him in his days, and he and his brother split. His brother went with instrumental music, and granddad wouldn't go. And so he was probably acquainted with some of the preachers I guess of today, like the Wallaces. He was raised in Montague County. He probably knew those fellas, the dad, you know. But he died in 1893. He was born in 1809 or 1816. He had three wives. And two passed away, and he married my great-grandmother. And my grandmother was the last of 23 children. And she was born 88, I think, or 87. So you can see how far back he went. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we've got a history in that. And I went to Austin, Texas, to the archives in the Capitol. Glenda wanted to look up on her family. I looked up on my great-granddad. And all we had in there, they had a list. Samuel Royal, it would say gospel preacher, Church of Christ preacher, you know, and it would say reverend. Mm-hmm. He didn't believe in that. And it had 30-some couples, the names of the bride and the groom, that he had married from 1869 to 1879, and told where he lived, you know, at the time. He's in that book, is it Eckstein, on the history of the church in Texas? Well, he's just, he gives a list of the preacher. He lists my great-granddad as the one at Forestburg that time. But anyway, Glenda has a great history from the McKinneys, you know. Mm-hmm. And that my father-in-law was named after those men. Colin Wilmoth was his name. But I figure my great history, and I call it that, was being with brethren that were down to earth and wanted nothing but the simple gospel, whatever the doctrine was. We studied chapters at Arvin. When I first started to even have anything to do with the pulpit, Dad would say, you can read so many verses here on our chapter study, maybe five, sit down. And so that went on for a time. Then he'd say, and the brethren agreed, he'd say, you can say what you have to say on these passages, study them out. Maybe whatever I read, five verses, take about 5 minutes, sit down. And we always respected the older men, so we did, my brother and I both, and the others also. But I can remember the Elliots moved out from Missouri in 1945, and they worshiped there with us at Arvin. We finally sealed that old building, put a floor in it. But brother, those cracks in that were 1x12 standing this way, the way it was. You can see outside, knot holes that go off with nailed tin can lids over it, you know. Kind of a humble circumstance, but we didn't figure it was, you know. And we built that building. I'll never forget Fred Kerbel came and held a meeting then before all the split on the marriage came over. And Fred got up the first night. He knew some of us from the sulfur meeting. And he looked at the building, you know, and the trusses up there, and he said, brother, you really have a nice building. He said, I'm glad to see brother moving out of the mule barns. He said, into good buildings. He said, my name is Fred Kerbo, not Cairo or Crowbar. It's Kerbo. He spelled it. My wife's name is Marion. She's with him, you know. His children are small. He named off their name, their age, his age, his wife's age, where he used to live in Wilson, Oklahoma. That's his home, you know, was then. And he went on several things like that, and he said, now then, have I overlooked anything that the brethren's wives really want to know? Then he started his preaching. Fred was a good preacher, really good. He's the one that got Brother Dewey Best to come back to church.
Okay.
He talked to Dewey. And Dewey never was a worldly man. I mean, he just wasn't. For all those years he was out, he lived the street over. And Dewey was instrumental in converting his neighbor. And his neighbor had been charismatic. He was about 70 years old. And he stayed with us till he died, Brother Kirkley. And he was a very jolly man. But Dewey and Ollie were the ones that converted him. It was really something because neighbors could invite neighbors and they'd come. And they lived it before them, you know. It wasn't like it is now. It's just hit and miss, you know. They were... But you think of it after the war, and that war was a bad thing. People were hungry for something better. We'd been in war, some of them lost boys, didn't know any better girls. Some of them, Brother Stewart, Sister Stewart's son, Manuel, he came back and he was blind. He was in the landings on these islands, South Pacific, and he was laying on the ground, and a hand grenade fell right there they'd thrown, you know. And before he could even move, it went off. It didn't kill him. Didn't even put scars, but it cut his optic nerve. But he was a very, he wasn't in the church that I know of, but he was a very, very self-efficient man. He'd walk with a cane over town. He became a kind of like a chiropractor. And Manuel took care of himself. But brethren that had been in the army, military, like Brother Jim Downham, who's 91 now, and Brother Noel Barrett, his brother-in-law, Noel was 90. They'd been in the service, they didn't know better. And so these meetings, you could drive your pickup or car up like this, sit in and listen to the preaching. We had microphones, and outdoor, and across the street was a park, and people in that park would listen. I remember one occasion, two men were standing over, older men, and Paul was holding the meeting outdoors, and he said, I've got $10 that I will give to any man, woman, or whoever that can tell me what I've preached here is not right, not according to Scripture. And these two men were arguing. He said, buy the truth and sell it not. And that's what I'm willing to give $10 to anyone. And this one old man told the other, and we found out from the old man, he said, I told him, said, you're disagreeing with all this preacher. I said, you can make $10 if you go then, just tell him. He didn't go. Things like that got people interested, you know. Jim Dallum came, and he finally just obeyed the gospel. It was really good, really good. I call it the good days, though you had to work hard for your living. But brethren were grounded and willing to work and begin to support other work. So it was really a great thing. But Paul and Chester were probably the two men in the beginning that really helped us the most. Now, Irvin held meeting. He'd come by and he'd stay with us. Maybe he'd be there two or three days. He had a trailer house behind my dad's house, a little small one, him and his first wife, Jean, which had been his sister.
Okay.
And Jean was a very lovable person and during the war. And it stayed there for about a year or so before he moved to Lawrenceburg. And he'd preach all in California. We didn't even know when he'd come in. Him and her, you know, maybe see a light late in the night. She told us, she said, the first few years of me and Irvin were married, she said, I can never remember him. In other words, I never remember him being in bed before I was, and I never got up before him. He was always up late, study all night, you know. At that time, he was a good gospel preacher, and he was influential. But Irvin, like the scripture says, and I'm trying to think of it, Chester used to quote it like Simon when he was little in his own eyes, you know. But he got to where he was bigger. He thought that brethren should support him more. And that really hurt him a lot, because brethren didn't go for that. They supported him adequately. But I'll give Irvin credit. He would go through the state here when he held me preaching. He got brethren to up their support, which wasn't sufficient one time. To the young man beginning and to the gospel preachers. And he's the one that really got it started. And of course, brethren held against him, you know. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, most brethren realize a gospel preacher has to be supported efficiently. And Paul Nichols, I'll never forget, he was there in the old building sitting on the front seat. He was there to preach. He's just a young man. And the brethren had agreed aforetime, whatever the contribution was, they would give it to Paul that day. That's how they supported him. Well, when the contribution came around, Paul reached in his pocket, and he hadn't segregated, would he? And he had a roll of money, not much. He just tossed the whole thing in. He's broke, you know. And the brethren had agreed to give him the contribution, so we gave Paul, said, brethren, sure, treated him wonderful. But I've got the book on the contribution when we met with Cups. And Mother wrote in there that across it the date that we changed to the true worship she put. And she kept track of it for Dad. And the contribution would be $1.50, $1.10. I mean, you know, we hadn't learned. Brethren worked on farms. But they still wasn't giving as they should. Wages were about 70 cents an hour, I think, then. And finally got up to 90 or a dollar. But when brethren learned, they began to give more and more. And I give Paul credit for that. He taught brethren on it. Irvin did too. And so it made a difference. But it shows you how little by little, as the church was growing in areas where it wasn't before, how brethren learned, you know. And those that were really stable stayed right in there with it. There were good days. We had some great singing, good teaching by brethren. And it was really good. Bakersfield and Arvin both worked together real close. They put up the building in Arvin as a collateral so we could have the building over on Plains Road where we bought it and planted it. And things like that really were great. That shows you, brother, what cooperation will do. Mm-hmm. And people that really want to be rooted and built up, you know. Not changeable, you know, with every wind of doctrine comes around. No. We enjoyed it. And I never thought of us being poor. We lived in a tent when I was a little guy. But a whole bunch of other people lived on that block and tent, too, you know. I thought we were rich. Dad got wood. One of my trousers made a little platform floor for Mother, and he sighted it about this high around it. So we really were uptown, man. Had two barrels out there with water and built around, and that was a shower for everybody, you know. So I didn't think it was poor. Everybody in the same boat. That was during the Depression, of course. Yeah. Finally come out of it during the war years because it supplied jobs, you know. Mm-hmm. But Dad was the type of fella, Brother King wrote this when he preached his funeral, or he said this, and he wrote the OPA. He said, here's a man, having learned the truth, would have nothing else. You couldn't move him. And really, that was sizing up my dad's feelings about what was right. And he sometime would, when we had a business meeting, he'd tell the brethren, listen, we have money to support work, and we're not doing it. And he could talk to them in a way, some were resented it at first, but most of the brethren would agree, and we'd just start supporting work. And afterwards, they would really get involved, you know. But I can remember Ray Nichols, Paul's brother under him, you know. He's buried right over here at the cemetery. And Ray would come up and preach. And he worked for Dad one time. Dad was roadside and hay, you know, so much avail. And Ray would work, physical work. And he married when Wilma was young. She's from Ceres over here. Anyway, we would pay his rent. Maybe it'd be five or two. It was recorded. Here it is. And Rod Wilson and I took care of his funeral over here. Paul told Wilma, she said, why don't you get Richard and Rod to do his funeral? So she did. She gave me a tie at it and a money clip, which I haven't used. Don't have the money. Anyway, I mentioned that. I said, I can remember when Ray used to preach as a young man. And he helped us at Arvin quite a bit. He was a good singer, good songwriter. And we would pay his rent, and maybe that was it. Maybe his support was $5, you know. But he worked to help his own support, help the church get going, change. So Ray Nichols was an instrument in us learning what was right and being strong too, you know. So that's it, except when I met your dad.
When did you meet Linwood?
I met Linwood in 1949, I believe it was. First sulfur meeting I came to was in 48. They met in what they call the Adventist Tabernacle across town over there. They built that one they have now in 1951. And so I was there in 49, 48, 49, 50. 51 and 52, and then I didn't go for till 56, year Glenn and I married. And then in 58, and I think I didn't go for 10 years. I couldn't afford to raise my family, and then we were back in 67, 68. But I met Linwood in 49, and Linwood came out here on his own to help us with the church, Brother Gay, Billy Jack Ivey, these other men I mentioned. And Brother Gay told Wayne and Johnny it was cotton picking time. And my mother would pick cotton. And she was a pretty good cotton picker. And he told Wayne and Johnny, he said, you boys need to go out there and picking up cotton to hold your mission meeting. So they went out with Mother. Of course, Wayne could pick. He could work when he wanted to. He didn't want to lift anything heavier than a pencil, you know, for years. But he could do it. And Johnny said, I think he bit 30 pounds one day, and he said, boy, if I could pick like your mama and your brother, he said, I think I'd do that to fall. You could hear Johnny grunting, he'd go, you know, pull a little bit out at a time. Mother used to take a whole bowl and roll it up and put it in a sack. It was kind of a comical thing, but I was still in school, still in high school. And I'd work on Saturdays with him. But I look back on those days, and they were really good times. Benny said, I couldn't preach, you know that. He said, I'd study all night after services to get ready to preach the next night on something.
Are there any sermons of like Homer King or Chester King or?
Yeah.
That stood out in your mind?
Yes. Brother King preached a sermon when several came up in the old building. The postmaster in town come up, obeyed the gospel. And that sermon was, the parable of the vineyard in Matthew 20. Now, Brother King could preach that with effect. And he really had the effect about the 11th hour, man, you know. And the Jacksons had come from Arkansas, and they felt like they hadn't been doing right. They'd missed again. And Brother Jackson was old. Him and Sister Jackson came up. And I don't know, about 6 or 7 that morning, confessed their wrongs. Of course, E.B. was baptized. He married one of the twins, Jackson twins, which is Sister Bonnie Johnson, still living. That was one of her sisters, two of her sisters. And those brethren then couldn't see me. They built that building. They'd come after work and work on it. And on Saturdays. And CB fell off that thing, you know, telling rough. And Michael John Carter was a tall man, I told you about it, very quiet. He fell off, but it didn't hurt him. They were back on the job. It was a great time. The digressive people, and couldn't get in town to have a congregation anymore for about 10 years. They couldn't get a foothold. And when things begin to get loosened up for them, you know, they begin to start. I don't know if they're there now. I can't tell you. One of my good friends was a Baptist, raised Baptist in school, Bob Craven. He married Catherine Clace, and her daddy was one of the elders of the Digressive Church. And I lost contact with Bobby as far as being close all the years we lived in Bakersfield. You know, he was there too. He worked as a kind of like a bookkeeper for the Kern County Land Company, which is a big outfit. And they sold to another company from Delaware. He worked for them, and they sold to Castle, that Hawaiian pineapple outfit. That's where he retired from. I didn't see Bob too much. But anyway, he converted over. He was one of their elders for a while, and he quit. I asked him why, And he said they were getting real loose on things. They wouldn't listen to him. He said, I'm not doing any good with these people. So he just resigned. He'd be a good man to have in the church. Bobby was raised with good family. His older brother is about 80. Let's say Jack would be 87, I think. And he lives over in Susanville, and he lives with his son now, and his wife died. He's a Baptist preacher, missionary Baptist. And Bobby never went. You know, he didn't go. He finally told him, he said, he was one of our ball players. He and I were the guards. He told him later in life, he said, I'm going to start doing like Richard. He said, Richard won't give up the church and meetings to play ball, and I need to be doing that. I was told that by one of his relatives, you know. But that Baptist didn't take on Bobby, I guess, you know. That I know of. I've thought, what if all these digressive churches in every land, especially here, what they call that main line, what if they got right back to the doctrine like it used to be, they used to stand for, except the cups and glasses, and took a stand for what was really scriptural and right, look how the church would be. They've got so many members, and some of them that are just coming members. If they divided that up, you'd have congregation everywhere, you know. We're in a period where we're losing ground, some of our young people, and some others that were not very strong. And I can name you a congregation in California that existed. I did a while ago. There are no more. People moved off, you know, for jobs, and some just quit. Who I thought never would. Anyway, brother, short history,
but
history, from the early 40s till now.